From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer David Sacks has seen his share of food trends come and go. His first encounters were simple enough, chicken fingers and fajitas, but then over time came the cupcake craze and the pork belly craze and ramen noodles and kale and sriracha sauce and the cronut, for crying out loud. Sacks says we are living in a gold rush of food trends, and in a new book he tries to figure out just how they work. It's like an ecosystem in some way. One movement bears on another, so in that way, these seemingly trivial trends have powerful effects on our culture, our economy, even our politics. David Sacks is joining us today to explain what drives these food trends, when they take off, and of course, why they fizzle out. Join us after the news. Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's easy enough to look down on the latest food trend as vapid or annoying, like gourmet toast or bone marrow or Mexican cinnamon. And all of that stuff, we should say, is delicious, by the way, but it's like any trend. It's cool in the early days, but then when everyone else finds it, we want to move on. In a new book, the writer David Sacks explores how food trends work. And you may be surprised to hear what a potent force they've been in our daily lives and in human history. Sacks says these trends are always in the process of a kind of feedback loop. There's this balance between innovation or creativity and following the herd. But without these trends, he says, restaurants, for example, would be serving the exact same dishes they did 40 years ago, would be eating roast beef and mashed potatoes night after night after night. Today in the program, David Sacks is joining us to talk about his book. It's called The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes but Fed Up with Fondue. David Sacks writes for The New York Times, for Bloomberg, Businessweek, and Savour. His new book is called, as we said, Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes but Fed Up with Fondue. And he's joining us today from a studio in Toronto. And David Sacks, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Doug.
Well, I wanted to start up by asking you what got you thinking about all of this. One thing that you've talked about is that you kept going to all these really cool restaurants, but you started noticing in these really cool places that a lot of them had the same kinds of things on the menu?
Yeah, I think we've all sort of experienced this, whether it is kind of, you know, cool, interesting places within our own city. So maybe the top, you know, three or four places that opened the past year in Salt Lake and are getting all the lineups, or places in, you know, you go to visit a place in Salt Lake one weekend, you go to another place in Provo the next weekend, Park City the weekend after that, Denver right. The weekend after that, and you're like, they all have a fish taco on their menu, or yeah. They all have this, you know, what did you say? Artisan toast with bone marrow and Mexican cinnamon.
Yeah. Which doesn't that sound good?
It could work, right? I think it could work. Kind of a Oaxacan West Coast thing.
Yeah.
You know, why is that? If these places are becoming famous for, or getting, you know, local accolades for being kind of the most innovative, creative restaurants in that particular market, or let's say even the nation, why is it that most of them are serving the same or similar things, that the same dishes, the same flavors, the same foods are popping up in all these different places? What's the process that drives that? And really, the greater question is, you know, how is our sense of collective taste yeah. shaped? And that is the process of food trends and how food trends start and grow and evolve.
You use the word ecosystem in the book. Is that the word for it? That it's part of this is organic, and there's a kind of one thing sort of feeds on another thing. And as I mentioned before, a reference to your book, there's this kind of feedback loop that's going on as well.
Yeah, certainly. Because while there is, an economy around this and a business around it, and most of it is a business, right? Whether it's somebody opening a food truck or a small restaurant or, you know, writing a cookbook, everybody's looking to make money in the food business, all the way up to Walmart and Whole Foods and, you know, Pepsi-Cola. But a lot of that's cultural too. Mm-hmm. What we like, what we're interested in, what we vibe with now versus last year. You know, the fact that our tastes for what we want are constantly changing is entirely a cultural issue. And because of that, it's very hard to directly predict what food is going to become the next trend. You know, there's contenders and there's ideas, but the culture is evolving and the trends that come up tend to evolve out of what's happening in our culture currently.
So they're not that much different from fashion, I guess.
No, except for the fact that, you know, fashion, I go shopping for clothes, I don't know, twice a year, let's say, to be generous. And, you know, a couple of things can last me for a while. And while I see those people who are very fashionable, you know, a lot of people can happily wear the same outfit year in and year out and just, you know, buy new socks when they get holes in them. But we have to eat 3 times a day, you know, maybe more. And we spend a tremendous amount of our energy in terms of time and income in terms of dollars on what we put into our bodies, on what we eat. And for most of us, that is presents constant opportunities several times a day to engage with culture and the economics of food trends.
It seems like in some ways, cupcakes were kind of a way in for you, at least on this subject. Because, you know, you talk about how when you would tell people, oh, I'm writing a book on food trends, and they were like, what does that mean? And then you say cupcake, and they're like, oh, that's a food trend that I absolutely understand. And you kind of break down how the cupcake transformed, because this was an element of your childhood, probably of a lot of our childhoods. You know, we knew cupcakes is that thing that mom made, but then along the way they became trendy, and that's when they became a trend. Talk a little bit about cupcakes.
Yeah, it's interesting because in the past week I've done a number of interviews with Reuters and the Washington Post and a number of other publications saying, you know, is this the death of the cupcake? Because there was the largest chain of cupcake bakeries called Crumbs, had closed all its stores. Now, apparently, it's being rescued by some other investors. But, you know, this was kind of the, is this trend finally over? And I think the reason why so many people cared about it is not because, you know, Crumbs was this massive employer and had this huge economic impact in the country. It was a fairly small chain in terms of food chains. But it was because it became the symbol of this, like, the defining food trend of the 21st century so far. The food trend that all other food trends are compared against. And so the process that had happened was really interesting because I like to say there's 3 factors that created the cupcake trend, right? As you mentioned before, Doug, you know, cupcakes were what mom made. They were what you had for birthday parties. They were kids' food, like chicken fingers. And then what happened in sort of the mid-1990s is that a number of small bakeries opened up in New York City and became popular by selling cupcakes. They didn't intend to, you know, they just made cupcakes out of extra cake batter, but they became popular. They hit on something. It wasn't an intentional thing, but it caught on. It became part of, you know, the popular culture for adults to go and wait in line and eat these cupcakes. And it grew for a number of years in New York City and you know, other people visiting New York sort of caught on and talked about it, but it wasn't a big thing. It was like a local phenomenon. And then a couple things happened. The first was in 2000, an episode of Sex and the City, the HBO television show, filmed 1 20-second scene at the beginning of one episode in front of Magnolia Bake Shop, the best known sort of place selling cupcakes, where 2 main characters, Carrie and Miranda, are sitting talking about someone that Carrie's dating, and they're eating cupcakes. That's it. They don't mention cupcakes. They don't. There's not a big Magnolia sign. There's no other, you know, instance of cupcakes on the show. Someone else told me the other day, well, there was one sort of episode where Carrie has a book launch party and they serve cupcakes, but that's it. Like, that was the only plot line, 20 seconds devoted to cupcakes to that whole show. But it forever associated the cupcake with Sex and the City. Yeah. And when you talk to people who open cupcake bakeries in Brazil and Paraguay and Pakistan, they're like, I got into it because of Sex and the City. So it changed the cupcake from this childlike, this child's treat, something you give a kid when they're good or it's their birthday, to something that was associated with everything that that show was associated with: women, sex, $500 shoes, dresses, sensuality, urban living, aspirational capitalism, right? So that's one thing.
Right.
The other thing was September 11th.
Yeah.
And what September 11th did was it, first of all, created a recession, which we forget now because it was overshadowed by, you know, the 2008 recession. But it was a substantial recession the year after September 11th across the country. And so it also created a war and this feeling that we were under attack. And I think all of us who were alive then really remember that feeling. I, even as a Canadian, remember it. And that sense of insecurity plays to food trends that are comforting and familiar,
yeah.
Right? When things are going bad, we don't want to go experiment with new things. We don't want to open ourselves up. We close ourselves off and we go towards things that are familiar, right? Gourmet hamburgers, grilled cheese, mashed potatoes and roast beef. You know, maybe they were done up, maybe they were better quality, but that's what people gravitate towards. And the cupcake was this edible security blanket that people kind of poured into. And then the third factor, which I think really drove the cupcake trend to something that, again, no other food trend had ever done before, was the internet, right? The cupcake trend started off in the mid-90s when AOL and Prodigy and all these different sort of online services, dial-up, were growing. But it popped right around the time when broadband internet started spreading all the way across the country, and then grew as blogs grew and Facebook started up and Twitter started up and Instagram started up and Pinterest started up, all of which allowed the spread of cupcake stories, cupcake reviews, photos of cupcake shops, photos of cupcakes, recipes, cupcake baking circles to proliferate without the boundaries of geography. So if you live in some small mining town in the Wasatch, you could go and click on, you know, any cupcake bakery's website and cupcake blogs and cupcake Pinterest feeds, and you could go and find what you need and bake the world's greatest cupcakes there in that small mining town in the Wasatch. Because you don't need to go fly to New York City or fly to LA and taste kind of the cupcakes at the best places. And the beauty of cupcakes is, you know, what do you need? Eggs, flour, sugar,
yeah.
Milk, and butter, right? Readily available ingredients that everywhere in the world can access. And so what that allowed was the cupcake to spread from something that was sort of local to this viral phenomenon. And that's how we got to the point where cupcakes are just this ubiquitous food trend everywhere.
So you get, so there's a build. It starts as something basic. It doesn't always work this way because we'll talk about some of the other elements here, but it starts as something fairly basic. It's familiar. It takes off for all these fascinating cultural reasons. It becomes, has this certain familiarity to it related to 9/11. But you say that it eventually, cupcake fever, as you say, eventually is going to break. And you have a sense that the cupcake, as you say, will kind of revert back to the kid-friendly food that we all sort of knew, that it'll recede eventually, I guess. That's part of this process?
Right, because there's only so many things you can do with it. There's been mini cupcakes, booze cupcakes. Some place I saw in Toronto that tried to open last year had sweet martinis garnished with cupcakes, like an olive, right? That's where you know it's like, okay, this, you are way over the shark. Like, you have soared over schools of sharks to get to this point. Because the food trend economy is an innovation economy. And there's only so much innovation that that something as simple as a cupcake can take. And it's very easy to do. And so it's spread geographically to every single corner of the world. There's been every possible variation of it. It exists in every price point from 50-cent cupcakes at, you know, Albertsons to $2,000 cupcakes that you can get in Dubai with a gold spoon and gold leaf on top and God knows, chocolate caviar on the middle or something like that.
Right.
There's nowhere else for it to go. And so anyone who's going into that business and investing in it and trying new things, trying to get people excited about it again, is really kind of scraping at the bottom of a barrel in terms of what they can do to drum up the public's interest in cupcakes. So that said, you know, the media has been over cupcakes for some time. They're
yeah.
sick about talking about them. But if you go to any cupcake bakery or any bakery that sells cupcakes in downtown Salt Lake or its suburbs or Park City or wherever, and you put a kid in front of that case or an adult who kind of is like 4 o'clock and, you know, they had lunch a couple hours ago and they're hungry, they're still going to buy that cupcake. And that's because at the end of the day, the cupcake is an individualized handheld portion of cake that's simple to eat and relatively affordable. And that's been its strength. And that's the reason why it won't just die off completely. Whereas some fattier things like cake pops and whoopie pies, which don't have the cultural history that the cupcake does, have kind of come and gone. And the cupcake has endured and will endure at birthday parties and, you know, bringing them to kindergartens or, you know, as a gift for graduation, because its fundamental appeal is it's just a small handheld cake. And, you know, you could be over the phenomenon of cupcakes, but I kind of question anyone who's over eating right. cupcakes.
You mentioned how food trends are not new. In fact, and this was intriguing, you write in the book that food trends are a natural byproduct of our evolution from hunter-gatherers. How are food trends related to our, you know, deepest sense of human history?
Well, as long as we've had the luxury of choosing between different foodstuffs to eat, i.e. not just eating purely for survival, but have been able to trade and grow different crops, as we've had that abundance, you know, the choices that we have created food trends. And so, you know, there are trends going back to the Middle Ages where, oh, there was a trend of, you know, amongst the royals of medieval England of decorating meat like fruit, right? There's no practical reason for doing that. It wasn't economical. It gave no advantage. It wasn't something that happened to be a hacky accident in the kitchen. It was just, this is a fashion of how we're eating. And you see it all throughout history of you know, different foods becoming popular at different times. I mean, the drive to explore the Americas was set off for sure gold and silk, but also spices, right? These, oh my God, we need more coriander. Like, we've tasted this and this is going to be the greatest thing right. in medieval Portugal. Like, go sail off the edge of the earth and find us, go get us some more paprika. And so you see it throughout history. I mean, coffee is a great example, right? This obscure bean from the highlands of Ethiopia catches on in Vienna and Italy and becomes this sensation that drives trade and economies and colonialism across the world and continues to evolve to this day. And so we see food trends, you know, it's not just a modern phenomenon. They are a necessary byproduct of our modern society. I just read a really fascinating book which came out last year called Mastering the Art of Soviet Cooking, which is by an American writer who grew up in the Soviet Union and sort of her memoir through food. And you see, even in the Soviet Union, even in a place of ration cards and deprivation, there were food trends, but they were driven by kind of the economics of what was available. But even then, it was, you know, this was fashionable at that time. Mm-hmm. So whenever there's choice, whenever we're just beyond simply thinking about food to not starve, we're going to pick certain things over others, and that creates food trends.
Here's a tweet from Amanda. She writes, I adore food trends, the fun ones anyway, like kale. She says she's annoyed that everything...
That's a fun one.
That's a fun one. I am interested in how that's fun. Dan writes, without food trends, I would never have learned that beets are delicious, not just the nasty nuclear-colored circles on my childhood cafeteria tray, which is part of that, right? I mean, a lot of us, that's how some of us probably encountered Brussels sprouts, is they became a food trend.
Yeah, Brussels. I mean, you know, Charlie Brown, right? It's like Brussels sprouts. You'd be like, wah, wah, wah. These Brussels sprouts were a punchline, and now they're the fashion star. They're kind of the belle of the ball because a couple of chefs, you know, paired them with bacon and made them sexy in the past 20 years, or not even 10 years. And so it's interesting to think about the things we eat now. Bone marrow, for instance, or kale, mm-hmm. which we consider kind of hot. And the things that we've discarded, fondue, panini sandwiches. I mean, remember how amazing those were in the 1990s? Yeah. Now nobody's going to be hard pressed, no pun
pressed,
intended,
yeah.
To sort of serve a panini sandwich at a kind of trendy restaurant. And why, you know, it's not like they're any less delicious. It's just, why did that change?
When we get back from a break, we'll talk about... I have to say, bone marrow sort of brings up one of the elements of food trends, the influence of chefs. I'm guessing this is a Fergus Henderson thing, or at least something like that. We'll talk about it when we get back from a break. David Sacks is with us. His book is called The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes But Fed Up with Fondue. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we're talking with the writer David Sacks about his book, The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes But Fed Up with Fondue. Food trends is what he's exploring and really breaking down in his book. David Sacks, let's talk about chefs and their influence on food trends, because you say that these chef-driven trends are pretty powerful and they can really, really alter the way we eat.
Yeah, well, you know, today chefs have a visibility that they've never had before.
Yeah.
You know, once upon a time, to know about a chef and for them to have influence, you really had to eat at their restaurant. Occasionally, you would get a chef like Wolfgang Puck, whose fame would sort of spread beyond the kitchen of Spago in Los Angeles through cookbooks and articles and interviews, but they were sort of few and far between. Today, with, you know, Top Chef, two seasons of Top Chef every year, and cooking competition shows, and, you know, food sections being beefed up in papers. It seems like it's the only part of the newspaper industry that's actually growing, plus food blogs and restaurant blogs and Yelp, and Chowhound, and all that. Even in a relatively small city like Salt Lake City, I'm sure there are a number of kind of quote-unquote rock star chefs or sort of local celebrity chefs who whose faces grace the local magazine or newspaper every single week, and who can't put a dish out of their kitchen without it being chronicled and Instagrammed and sort of commented upon instantly. And so because of that, you know, what chefs do in their kitchen, what influential chefs do, has a really big impact beyond their restaurants. So, for example, the chef Rene Redzepi, who runs the acclaimed restaurant Noma in Copenhagen, Denmark, which has won the Best Restaurant of the World award for a number of years. You know, I've never eaten there. I know maybe one or two people who have eaten there, but I have seen and tasted his influence in dozens and dozens of restaurants because he's constantly written about, he's constantly interviewed, he's constantly photographed, people constantly talk about it. And I've had chefs who say, you know, yeah, he's a big influence of mine. Have you ever been there? No. Have you worked in his kitchen? No. But, you know, I read about him in Food and Wine, or I read about him in the New York Times, or I saw a TV show about him on Food Network or whatever. And so these flavors, these techniques, these ingredients, sometimes the exact dish that these chefs make can transport themselves around the world and influence not just what you find in other sort of similar restaurants, but eventually, you know, the flavor of Doritos you're eating or the food that's in your pantry.
You know, it's interesting. I like the section about Sang Yoon, this chef based in Los Angeles. He starts this restaurant called Father's Office. It's this gastropub in Southern California. And Yoon really wanted to perfect the hamburger. So he kind of deconstructs it, and he creates the this what he calls the office burger. It became kind of famous there, and it really took off as a trend, got kind of ridiculous as a matter of fact. But it kind of reflected, and I wanted you to talk about that, the way you say the office burger became this kind of opening salvo in a revolution that changed the way we eat in restaurants. This seems like an important trend. So talk about that one too.
Yeah. Well, you know, what he did, I mean, a lot of other people were doing it at that time. And I think he laid claim to it in a way that others have certainly disputed. But, you know, there are a number of restaurants that exist around the country then and a number of chefs since that. So there was, you know, the two trends that came out of it. The one is sort of the gourmet burger trend. And that and everywhere just sort of opened up the burger market to, you know, $30 burgers, $40 burgers, $50 burgers. It was like the arms race of expensive, ridiculous burgers. But overall, the rising tide of idiotic burgers lifted the fortunes of most burgers. So even your average hotel or sort of basic restaurant suddenly was serving, you know, pasture-raised ground chuck sirloin mixes. I mean, I remember the burgers eating burgers at like Park City 10 years ago on ski vacation. And it was like your average ski hill cafeteria burger, which is to say overpriced and fairly inedible. And then 2 years ago when I was there, it was, you know, they're boasting about where the meat comes from and how good it is. And it was a good burger. It was vastly superior. Obviously more expensive, but, you know, it's a license to print money. And that's what happened, right? But the other thing that happened with Sang-yoon and a number of other chefs, like David Chang from Momofuku in New York, is that they shifted the paradigm of what restaurants could and should be and where good cooking should be, from, you know, white tablecloth, European food, fine dining, formal service, fancy, to great food served in any sort of atmosphere, loud, raucous, inexpensive, very informal. You want to wear jeans, you can wear jeans. The chef isn't even wearing a chef jacket. They're just wearing, you know, their own shirt, and they got a lot of tattoos, but they've been trained by the best in the world and they're familiar in these sort of techniques. And I think that's what Sang-yoon was sort of getting at is, you know, that, yes, there's this burger, but there's also the fact that, you know, a great chef can go and concentrate on a burger. And of course, we've seen that. It's been the greatest change in dining in America, and I think around the world, in a generation or more, is this complete and utter embrace of sort of low and familiar cuisine by high-end chefs. Mm. So you get the best restaurants in the world making hamburgers.
Here's a question, comes from Bad Brad. It's via tweet. He says, are cocktails food trends? He said, I'd never heard of a cosmopolitan until Sex and the City. And bitters, he says, seem to be trending as well.
Yeah. The cocktail food trend has kind of, it's funny, the cocktail trends tend to mimic what's going on in the food trend world. Mm-hmm. So when things are getting kind of candy-like and done up and post Sex in the City, you know, they had that whole every single color martini and every single flavor. And then as everything else becomes handmade and artisan, you had this artisan cocktail movement where they're not only, you know, making their own bitters, but like they get their ice from some glacier
in Peru.
In Antarctica. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The cocktail trends change again along with the times. I mean, just think about beer, the rise of kind of the artisan beer trend or the craft brewing trend over the past number of years. I think this is something that, you know, has always been very strong in Colorado and Idaho and sort of the mountain states, for some reason I recall this. But now, you know, the craft beers are everywhere. You can't even find a regular lager or a pilsner. It's all these like overly hoppy, you know, three guys in a basement making beers. It's like we make six beers a year, six actual bottles, but you know, they're amazing. And so these things, they're constantly changing. And again, it lifts it. So it's like you can laugh at that, right? You can laugh at the ridiculousness of the guy in the speakeasy bar where you have to, you know, knock on the door and they let you in and everybody has these twisty mustaches and suspenders and they're like, you know, chipping the ice off and everything's so freaking earnest. It's ridiculous. But the quality of your cocktail at the average hotel bar goes up because of that, because those bartenders go to those bars, see what's there, taste it, say, you know what, we could do better than the like standard, you know, vodka and soda. We can do better. Like there's something we can do better. We can get more creative. We can use better quality ingredients. And so, you know, everyone's fortune rises.
A cupcake is an example of this existing food that became a trend, but you work through a food trend that sort of begins from the ground up. And I wanted to talk about the agricultural food trends because this is an interesting part of the book. You say that starting a food trend from agriculture You describe it as one of the riskiest, most ballsy things that an entrepreneur can do, which kind of leads us to Glenn Roberts, a really great character in the book. Talk about this part of food trends.
Well, I think just the sheer process of agriculture in itself is what makes it so risky and so ballsy. And that's the fact that you can't just, go into your kitchen and whip something up. You have to, get land, develop a seed, plant it, and then each generation, which could be, 6 months or a year as that crop goes from seed to flower to fruition to harvest, is, again, crossbred and weeded out and examined for sort of the ones that have the best properties. Mm. And so it takes just to develop, let's say, a new strain of rice, which Glenn Roberts does regularly. For your readers, he owns a company called Anson Mills, which makes heritage southern grains in South Carolina and sort of around the rest of the South. So different varieties of wheat, different varieties of corn, different varieties of rice that historically existed in the South and were sort of lost to monoculture over time. And so it could take him, 5-10 years to get a strain of wheat to the exact specification he wants to turn it into flour and then sell it to chefs who are his customers. And because of that, it's very risky. If, you have drought or disease or flooding, your efforts are wiped out and set back by a year or more. And you have to deal with crop prices. You have to deal with irrigation. It's very capital intensive. It's not like opening up a cupcake shop. But because of that, because of the time it takes to do it, it's not like these things can kind of disappear in a heartbeat. Kale has been this very interesting thing that, again, it existed. Kale had always been around. But as it became popular, as people developed new strains of kale, baby kale, red kale, rainbow kale, purple kale, whatever, all these different types of kales, the supply of kale grew and there was more kale in supermarkets and people were investing more in storage and packaging of kale. And so because of that, kale has been very resilient because it's good and it has good properties, but also because it took so long to grow to that point, it can't just disappear like that. It's not the type of fad where it's like, oh, April, kale's really hot this season. It's going to be hot for a while. Whereas something like a packaged product, let's say sriracha flavored Doritos, for example, could be good this year, and people have moved on to some other flavor next year, Mexican cinnamon.
Right. You know what I like about the conversation or the section about Glenn Roberts? He's such an interesting guy. He flew jets. He sailed around the world. He worked on shrimp boats. And it seems like the people who start these trends, even those guys, as you say, who are producing the 6 bottles of beer in their basement, they're a little crazy, they're eccentric, but they're deeply passionate and they care a lot. And it comes through in the book that you have a kind of an affection for these kinds of people.
Yeah, you have to, first of all, as an eater, there's always this thing of think about who makes your food and who produces it. And yeah, you're like, okay, yeah, sure. Someone's back there in the kitchen. But, there are a lot easier jobs and livings in this world than going into the food business. Whether you're starting a food truck or working in a restaurant as a chef or a waiter, growing rice on a farm in South Carolina. It's kind of a maniacal business. And these people who are doing it are really kind of passionate about these things. I mean, when you talk to someone in the food business that's trying to get something off the ground, that's trying to make something trendy, their love of it and their passion for it is just so apparent. They're true entrepreneurs in that sense. And I talk to a lot of entrepreneurs and I know people in sort of the tech business and the app business. And yeah, they have a passion of their own and they're very passionate about whatever app it is or whatever software or product they're creating. But, for these food people, they really believe that this is this is the future. This is the thing that everyone's going to get into, whether it's, you know, packaged mango lassi drinks that my brother's friends who he went to Cornell with have sort of made and now have in Whole Foods, and they're growing, and they think that this is, you know, this will be the next Snapple, is Indian style lassies. Or whether it's someone like Glenn Roberts who believes that, you know, China black rice is going to be the next grain on America's table. It's infectious. That type of passion is infectious. And it comes through, you know, when you talk about their food, but it also comes through when you eat it, I think.
David Sacks is with us. His book is The Tastemakers, Why We Are Crazy for Cupcakes But Fed Up with Fondue. We'll take another quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, David Sacks is with us. We're talking about his book, The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes But Fed Up with Fondue. It's about food trends. Here's an email from local food writer Ted Scheffler, who writes, "It seems to me that there was a time when you couldn't give away raw mussels, skirt and flank steak, kale, pork belly, Brussels sprouts, and the like. But then," he says, "street tacos became hip and flank steak prices went through the roof. Ditto for Brussels sprouts and for kale and all the rest." He writes, "I guess the downside of food trends for the everyday cook and consumer is that formerly cheap foods become gourmet with retail prices to reflect their trendiness." This does happen, I guess, right, David Sacks?
Yeah, that's a great examples there. And he mentions pork belly. I mean, pork belly, which bacon is made from, you know, was a cut that they couldn't give away in the 1980s and 90s as people were afraid of fat. Saturated fat was bad. It was sort of the devil. And bacon was only really had for breakfast. And then the bacon trend kind of took off, largely because the pork industry pushed restaurant chains to start putting bacon on their sandwiches. And the restaurant chains were happy to do it as long as those sandwiches could sell. And pork belly prices rose tenfold to the point where, you know, pork belly futures trading, which you might remember from the film Trading Places.
That's right.
Short pork bellies, Mortimer. Anyway, they ceased because the demand for pork bellies is now so incessant and consistent that there's no volatility to the market. They're smoking as many pork bellies as they can get off those hogs. But, you know, to the flip side of Ted Scheffler wrote, is that, you know, the pricing out of those things like flank steak then drives people to say, okay, what's next? Is it beef shank? Is it oxtail? Like, what else can I cook that's going to be less expensive? What aren't I looking at? What can I put on my restaurant menu that's going to still give me that profit margin, but it'll be different and innovative? And so that, as things become trendy, as they pick up, as they become, you know, mainstream and ubiquitous, not only do chefs and cooks and just average shoppers move on from them because of, you know, a cultural fatigue or a taste fatigue, they do so because of a price fatigue, but that pushes innovation to the next thing. What else can we look at? What are the other foods that we can try? What can we substitute that's going to give us something interesting? And so we're constantly moving and evolving, which I think is a benefit of these trends.
Here's an email from David who writes, "I've noticed an increase in the price of quinoa in the last couple of years." He says, "I've heard that forests are being cleared to grow quinoa in Bolivia and Peru, etc. I've seen quinoa in crackers and granola and other trendy snack foods more and more recently, it seems." And he wonders if the nutritional benefits of quinoa, for example, outweigh the cost of deforestation, if this is in fact true. I mean, what are the larger economic or even environmental impacts of these food trends?
Yeah, and I think the quinoa is a very good example of that, because it was this relatively obscure grain from South America that, you know, was eaten by, and certainly in Peruvian or Bolivian culture, and those cuisines, and then became this health trend and a health and diet trend. And health and diet trends tend to be some of the biggest, most pervasive trends because they are a means to get you to part with your money, and you can kind of slap them onto anything. Something like quinoa, something like chia seeds, also grown in South America, also, again, growing wildly as people, you know, become infatuated with it. Anything with a superfood label slapped onto it, which is a relatively meaningless term, but again, you know, people will part with their money because they feel it. It does everything from, you know, makes them lose weight to prevent getting cancer. And so, you know, do the health benefits of it outweigh the risk or the damage that's done to those environments? I hope not. I mean, I don't think that the benefits of any one food are so tremendous that it justifies, you know, destroying an ecosystem or impoverishing, you know, certain nations. And what will happen, as has happened with other trends, is that it will get to a point where the price of quinoa will be unaffordable because of this. And that will drop demand because it's too expensive to put into crackers or sodas or cereal. And they'll move on to something that's less expensive and more readily available and confers the same, you know, quote unquote benefits as quinoa does.
You know, this expresses a point you make in the book that all food trends have life cycles. And I wanted to talk about the end of your journey in this book, because you made your way to Tampa, and you wanted to go to Tampa to kind of understand what happens to a food trend once it passes to the other side, as you put it in the book.
Yeah, and Tampa, interestingly, was kind of the resting place of the great fondue trend that sort of kicked up in the 1960s and really peaked in the 1970s. You know, fondue restaurants, but fondue parties, fondue sets, those sets that are now sitting in everyone's garage and everyone's basement. You know, every ski chalet in both big and little Cottonwood Canyons has got, my parents, they have a timeshare in Snowbird, and there's like, you know, constant stories of fondue from back in the first couple of years when they had it. Yeah. And now it's, you know, it's been replaced by, I don't know what people are eating there, quinoa, probably. So interestingly enough, when the fondue trend really was kind of dying in the late 70s, a couple people started a restaurant in originally in Orlando called The Melting Pot, which was a fondue restaurant. And The Melting Pot is now the world's largest fondue chain, with some 200-plus locations around North America and a growing number in the Middle East. And even now that, you know, fondue is no longer trendy, and they fully acknowledge that, it's interesting to see how they keep it alive, how they keep innovating, and how they try to put a new face on fondue and give it a new life and bring people in to get, you know, fondue moving again. And the chain does well, and they've grown because it isn't something that everybody does on a Friday night, so it's a special occasion place. The customers of The Melting Pot come in twice a year on average for a birthday or a graduation, but because it's no longer this ubiquitous trend that everybody does a fondue party, you know, all throughout the winter, it becomes special. And then there's the legacy of what the fondue trend left with us, right? You know, all sorts of melted dips, molten chocolate cakes, these sorts of things. There's the whiff of fondue, the sort of cheesy, stinky whiff of fondue around them. And while food trends fade, they don't die off. So as to bring it back to what we were talking about at the beginning with the cupcake, you know, the cupcake stories might end, cupcake blogs might end. You know, my little one-year-old daughter won't have a cupcake onesie to wear on her body with like a "I'm a little cupcake" symbol on it. That will fade, but kids will still be getting cupcakes. People will still like cupcakes. People will bake cupcakes. They just may not be the cupcakes with a capital C, they'll just be back to being cupcakes with a lowercase c.
Well, what I liked about the fondue section is that it kind of left you with this sense that, or this understanding anyway, that food fads, they give you pleasure because, at least with fondue and a lot of other trends, I suppose, they were about sharing food with other people. And that's a pleasure, you say, that will never diminish. And I guess in some way, maybe that's why that's an important point you make, is that, you know, we're together, we've gathered together, we're sharing, we're engaging. And that's an important point, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, you know, one of the great legacies of the fondue trend is that people are now more willing to share plates, share communal things, even if it isn't, you know, a cauldron of Gruyere. It manifests itself in different ways. And so food trends will leave us with a legacy that, you know, may not be as apparent immediately, but it pushes things forward, right? The great sort of fusion, Asian fusion trend of the 1990s, which was really a lot of, you know, soy sauce on French food, or sort of a combination of Japanese and French food, it got ridiculed, it got mocked, it got overdone and overwrought. But, you know, today, as we're eating Korean tacos and kimchi-laced sriracha burgers, you know, that legacy has remained with us. Every food trend pushes our taste forward a little. It makes us more adventurous. It makes us more open to trying new foods and new flavors. It pushes people to innovate and open new restaurants and new lines of products. And I think that's what's great about them, why they're such a fundamentally positive force, even if they may get overwrought at times and, frankly, you know, annoying. Even when you're sick of hearing about kale or quinoa or right. kimchi or any of the other sort of K and C's, you know, the legacy that they leave us is generally positive. And that is that, you know, we are a culture that loves to eat and we are constantly looking for new things to eat. And because of that, there's never been a better time to eat.
Let me ask you, what are the trends that you're seeing these days? There's a trend. Here's a question, actually, that wonders, is the communal dining experience on its way out? It seems like we're past peak communal.
We're back to individualized portions.
Right. I mean, remember, that was sort of, and it still is, certainly in a lot of restaurants. And I guess this is one of those influences, I suppose, of chefs in the dining experience. But, you know, we were really communal for a long time. Is that a trend that's sticking around or is it going away? Do you have a sense?
I think these things kind of vacillate, and they take different forms. So the communal thing, you know, a couple of years ago, it was a big deal that everybody, they had these long kind of bench tables that everybody in the same restaurant would sit at, and people, you know, wanted to sit at an individual table. They didn't want to share their date with five other people. They didn't want to necessarily eat from the same plate as other people. But, you know, they just get reinvented. So some years it'll be more communal. Some years it'll be more individualized. Then someone will do something. It'll be a different kind of communal experience, like shabu-shabu, sort of Chinese-style, Japanese-style hot pot cooking. And then, you know, you have to eat that in a communal way. And that'll become trendy. And then, of course, it'll kind of vacillate back. You know, the pendulum will swing again to more individualized things. So those types of dining, they're you know, constantly changing. And I don't know if that's on the – it doesn't seem as prevalent as it was a couple of years ago, or at least it seems to be good in the places where it works well. You know, it's never going to go out of style for Chinese food. Yeah. But the types of foods like – fondue, for example, that just don't make sense as individual portions. But communal dining for the sake of communal dining hasn't, you know, it was the type of thing that was kind of interesting and fun. And then once you've tried it, you sort of move on. You go back to your individual steak.
What did you learn from your exploration of the cronut craze? You write a little bit about this. I mean, you found your own version of the cronut there in Toronto.
Yeah, which was very tasty. I could not deny it. The Corona craze was it sort of showed the future of what food trends are going to be like, which is bigger, faster, and more widely spread than ever before. That was something that if the cupcake took, you know, 15 years to go from a local phenomenon in New York to something that you can have in you know, a small village in Rwanda, the Cronut did that in you know, 3-4 months. And because of the speed of the internet, because of the way we talk about feud now and communicate images and ideas and words about it, you know, there's no limit anymore to where and how fast food trends can spread. And so you're going to see more and more. You're going to see food trends exploding instead of just growing quickly and dying off even quicker.
Let me ask you this finally. We've got about a minute left. Because you mentioned in the book, at some point during your reporting of all of this, you say you realized just how lucky you were to be doing this for a living. And you say food trends bring us happiness.
Yeah, I really do think they do. I mean, I approach this with a tremendous amount of skepticism. I was an, oh, gosh, cupcake person. But that changed as I began to, again, you know, feel the infectiousness of these people and eat at these places and see that there is no downside to food trends. Food trends bring us new flavors, new tastes, introduce us to things that we may never have had, like quinoa, or things that we never would have liked before, like beets, as someone wrote in before said. You know, they are what define us as a society. And I sort of tend to put it this way. You know, if you ever traveled to somewhere abroad, like Italy or even Mexico, where the food is fantastic, and you're there for the first couple days and you're eating tacos on the beach and, wow, I'm going to have a fish taco every day. Or I was in Jamaica a couple years ago. I'm like, this is great. I'm going to have jerk chicken every single day. And by the fifth day, I was like, all right, I need something else besides jerk chicken. What else do you have? They're like, we got jerk chicken, we got patties, we got oxtails. I'm like, what else? Like, do you have any Chinese food or is there any Japanese? They're like, no, jerk chicken. And yet you come back to North America where, you know, our food world is kind of driven by food trends and driven by new ideas and new things. And you can get anything anywhere. And people are always trying to bring you something newer and tastier and more delicious than ever before. And that's what's amazing about them. They really do just, you know, they are the driving force behind our eating happiness, I think.
It's David Sacks. This book is The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes But Fed Up with Fondue. Joined us from a studio in Toronto. David Sacks, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Why not?